So there has never been any intention on our part to disrupt anything. And I think that they were hoping to stop us from staging a large peaceful protest on the edge of the coronation. I think that that was a spectacularly poor decision for all sorts of reasons, not least because there was no grounds for arresting us. And it is an affront to democracy, an attack on our rights. But also it's backfired in the sense that, you know, this has become a major news story over the coronation weekend.
Ahead of King Charles' coronation, groups from 12 former British colonies wrote a letter demanding the new king pay reparations and apologize for Britain's legacy of genocide and colonization. We're joined now by Priya Gopal, an English professor at University of Cambridge, author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Dissent. Her latest piece for Al Jazeera English is headlined, "With Charles III Coronation, Colonialism is Coming Home to Roost." Well, Priya Gopal, can you start off by just talking about the resistance this weekend to the coronation? How widespread is this critical discussion critical of the king? Is this a common topic this weekend? And what that letter meant from the former colonies?
Yeah, hi, Amy. I think there are two things to say about resistance. One is that what was striking for those of us who have been here for many years and watched jubilees and other celebrations is that the public celebrations were relatively muted. I don't think that the crowds in London were quite as thick as they were even for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. I think certainly where I live in Cambridge, celebrations yesterday, the street parties were quite muted. And we know from a recent poll that support for the coronation or interest in the coronation was actually very low, with only about 9% of the population seriously committed to it and interested in it. In terms of criticism, there is quite widespread rumbling. And of course, Republic, the campaign group you referred to, tried to protest and they were stopped almost immediately. In the public sphere, in the media sphere, there is very, very little representation of anti-monarchy positions or even positions that are, you know, moderately critical of the monarchy or of the imperial system. So there's a kind of odd combination of increasing lack of interest in the monarchy, but a refusal on the part of the media, particularly the BBC, to acknowledge that there is rising criticism and rising disinterest. The arrest of the protesters before they even began to protest, and there were two groups, by the way. One group was Republic, who were arrested before they had even downloaded their placards. Another was a women's group called Night Stars, who were trying to hand out rape alarms. And they were also hassled by the police, and the rape alarms were seized, and they were not allowed to distribute them. Now, this is connected to a very disturbing development in Britain, which is the Public Order Bill, which was recently passed by the Conservative government. And what it has done is it has given the police sweeping powers to determine who can protest and how far, and whether those protests should go ahead. The Metropolitan Police, the day before they arrested Graham Smith and others, actually said, astonishingly, that they would not allow anybody to undermine the celebrations. Note the language, not criminal activity, not disruption, but you would not even be allowed to undermine the celebrations, which means it can be anything from, you know, looking grumpy might be seen as undermining the celebration. And I think we are in a situation where the police have been given extraordinary powers. And this is a very, very dangerous point where the media and the police are colluding in essentially suppressing criticism of the monarchy and what has been going on around the coronation.
Professor Gopal, Britain was one of the largest, if not the largest, slave trader in the Atlantic in the 18th century. Can you talk about that history and how much of it is widely known?
there is very little public knowledge in Britain about either the empire or the years of enslavement. In recent years, thanks to the efforts of young people who've been demanding reparations, repairing of their curriculum, and young people who've been demanding more knowledge about slavery and empire, there's a little bit more. But the British school curriculum is famously and woefully inadequate in terms of how much it teaches people about these things. The other thing to say is that what is now very slowly starting to come out, which is the monarchy's own implication in enslavement and in colonialism. And I mean in two senses. One, individual members of the royal family over the centuries. Now we know that some of them had direct benefits, like King William III, from enslavement. But then the monarchy as an institution also has investments in these different enterprises. We won't know about these until Charles agrees to let researchers access the royal archives, because one of the things that the monarchy has done, and this was especially virulent during Elizabeth II's time, was cover itself up in a kind of vast number of secrecy laws, which meant that researchers to this day haven't been able to access relevant archives, which would actually show us the extent of the involvement of the monarchy and individual members of the monarchy in enslavement. You had asked me at the beginning of the show about the letter from indigenous leaders and others calling on Charles to acknowledge the legacies of colonialism and enslavement. Now, this is actually a very, very big deal, because this is a country that has been historically loath to talk about colonialism or enslavement, unless it is to say that, you know, Britain was the nation that freed people from slavery. You're only allowed to talk about that particular dimension of slavery. Now, the letter from Indigenous and other leaders, particularly leaders from Australia, is very far-reaching. It is asking not only for the return and repatriation of artifacts and human remains, which I think Britain is, you know, slowly turning towards doing, but it's also asking Charles to do something that the monarchy has historically not done, which is make an acknowledgement of how consequential enslavement, dispossession, settlement, and other aspects of colonialism were. And I think that until we see real movement in this direction, most of us will remain skeptical that any such far-reaching acknowledgement is going to happen.
Last question. We have less than a minute. With Charles III coronation, colonialism is coming home to roost, you write, Professor Gopal. Why don't we end with that, your explanation?
Well, there are four things that distinguish colonialism: the enrichment of a small plutocratic class, the immiseration of a vast laboring class, an increasingly ferocious state that clamps down on protest, and heightened racialization, where outsiders are demonized. And all four of these aspects are present in Britain today. We also have, along the lines of what your previous guest was talking about, tremendous demonization and hostility and racialization of asylum seekers here, while ordinary British people are being made very, very poor. I mean, there are vast numbers of people unable to heat their homes and unable to feed their children. And we see, you know, looking at Britain today, if you set aside the small class of very, very, very wealthy billionaires, we see a very large number of very impoverished people. And you see Britain looking much like one of the colonies that it left behind in the middle of the 20th century.
Priya Gopal, I want to thank you for being with us. English professor at University of Cambridge, author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Descent. We'll link to your piece in Al Jazeera. With Charles III coronation, colonialism is coming home to rest. Next up, we look at the growing calls for new ethics rules for the Supreme Court justices as more information emerges about Justice Thomas's secretive dealings with a Republican billionaire. Back in 30 seconds.
What I want, you got, but it might be hard to handle, like a flame that burns.
Make My Dreams Come True by Hall & Oates. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Calls are growing for new ethics rules for Supreme Court justices as more information emerges about Justice Clarence Thomas's secretive financial dealings with the Republican activist billionaire Harlan Crow. Last month, ProPublica revealed Thomas had failed to report frequent luxury trips paid for by Crow, including trips aboard Crow's private yacht and jet. Thomas also failed to disclose he'd sold property to Crow, including a home where Thomas's mother now lives rent-free. In addition, Crow paid for the private school tuition for Thomas's grandnephew, including a year at Hidden Lake Academy in Georgia, where the tuition is over $6,000 a month. Also, The Washington Post has reported conservative judicial activist Leonard Leo arranged for the Judicial Education Project to secretly pay Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, $80,000 for consulting work over a decade ago without mentioning her name. Months later, the nonprofit filed an amicus brief in the landmark case Shelby County versus Holder, in which Clarence Thomas cast the deciding 5-4 vote that gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Despite these revelations, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts has refused calls to issue new ethics rules for justices. And then we've got the case of his wife getting over $10 million for being a headhunter for elite firms. This is Chief Justice Roberts' wife. And these law firms often have cases before the Supreme Court. We're joined now by Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Her recent book is titled Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America, joining us from Seattle, where she spoke at the Crosscut Ideas Festival. Dahlia, thanks for joining us again on Democracy Now! Can you respond to this avalanche of information, starting with Justice Thomas, but not ending with him?
It's such an amazing story, Amy, and it is really, in some sense, surprising to me that a story that I thought would be a one-day story when we heard the super yacht story and the travel story has turned into weeks of sustained focus as investigative reporters for a whole bunch of outlets essentially say, but that's not all. And I think you're quite right. The capstone of it, in some sense, were the stories at the very end of last week, both about Harlan Crow paying for Clarence Thomas's grandnephew's tuition, never, ever disclosed, despite the fact that Justice Thomas earlier in his career had disclosed that he was getting his tuition paid for. So he knew this required disclosure. And then, in some sense, the thermonuclear story that came last Thursday night, that, as you said, Leonard Leo, who is sort of the front man for a whole bunch of groups that have worked to take over the court, was quite literally directing Kellyanne Conway to put money in Ginny Thomas's pocket and included a note that said, quote, no mention of Ginny, of course. He knew this was wrong. Nobody disputes it's wrong. Now what we're really doing is haggling about the price.
I want to go to Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin, interviewed on CNN by Jake Tapper Sunday.
So because of the separation of powers, I believe, you're not willing to subpoena the Chief Justice, John Roberts. You've indicated that it's unlikely you're going to be able to pass any legislation that would impose an ethics code on the court. And you've said you don't think the Justice Department should investigate Justice Thomas's actions. So in essence, aren't you kind of throwing up your hands and saying the Supreme Court isn't really accountable to anybody but themselves? There's nothing you can do, even though you're the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Not at all, Jake. Let me just tell you the bottom line is this. Everything is on the table. Day after day, week after week, more and more disclosures about Justice Thomas. We cannot ignore them. The thing we're going to do first, obviously, is to gather the evidence, the information that we need to draw our conclusions. I'm not ruling out anything.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, if you can respond.
We're in such a weird moment, Amy, historically, where for some reason Congress has taken the posture that they can't do anything to regulate the court, and the court conveniently takes the same posture, that this is a separation of powers issue, a judicial independence issue. It's really useful to remember, and Professor Steve Laddick at UT Austin has been making this point for weeks, that Congress has regulated the court's conduct for for centuries. Congress has determined the jurisdiction of the justices. For a long time, Congress forced the Supreme Court justices to, quote, ride circuit, travel around the country and hear cases. Congress has set the number of seats on the court. So the notion that Congress has no business intervening with how the judiciary works, because that would be a separation of powers conflict, is simply wrong. And I think what you were hearing there from Senator Durbin is an understanding that now is not the time to stand back and let the court say more or less what you talked about in your last segment. The judiciary is a monarchy. It cannot be regulated by anyone other than itself. It seems as though between the hearing we had last week at the Judiciary Committee and the conversation we're hearing over the weekend, that members of the Senate are beginning to understand that it is going to be incumbent on them to step in and issue some ethics rules or demand that the court issue ethics rules for itself. That's the Angus King, Susan Collins bill. But that the notion that there's absolutely nothing that the other branches of government can do because the court is made of magic and unicorn and rainbows, I think that era is now over.
Now, federal judges are much more strictly regulated. Is that right? And aren't there judges across the country that are demanding that the Supreme Court abide by similar rules?
It's been such an amazing revelation. We heard over the weekend that there was a lower federal court judge, a district court judge, who was asking the body that the judicial conference that enforces rules to do something about Justice Thomas a decade ago. So, yes, it is absolutely true that lower court judges are bound by really strict rules. You can't buy them a cup of coffee. I know federal judges who won't get in an elevator with someone who's got business before them. They are very careful to police themselves because they understand, and this is in the Federalist Papers, that the only power the judiciary has is public approbation, and that that is an incredibly fragile thing. And so the idea that the Chief Justice put forth when he said he was not going to come testify before that hearing last week, that somehow it's unreasonable to ask judges to police themselves or that they should be left to determine their own ethics rules. It's not just a question of, you know, this looks kind of hinky. It's that they are undermining the integrity of the judicial branch. Every judge except the Supreme Court justices have to abide by the ethical canons and by the statutes. The notion that there's some sphere of privacy in Clarence Thomas's personal life, or that Leonard Leo said, oh, you know, we didn't disclose this donation, this payment to Ginny Thomas because the gossips were going to go after Clarence Thomas. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. They are meant to use these laws to guide their conduct, and they choose not to.
Dahlia, let's talk about the specific issue of student debt, because before the Supreme Court is the case of student debt argued in February. Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice Roberts, expressed extreme skepticism. Even this week, the debt ceiling issue could stop all kind of student loan forgiveness. So it's extremely significant that Clarence Thomas had his grandnephew, who he treated as a son. They sort of adopted early on. This Republican activist billionaire paying over $6,000 a month. Are we talking about crossing a line between civil and criminal liability here?
It's really difficult to know what Harlan Crow could be on the hook for, Amy. I certainly think we are crossing the line between ethical rules and corruption. And it's worth noting right here that the Supreme Court has been one of the largest players in changing the definition of what corruption is, demanding that we talk in terms of quid pro quo corruption, which is a really narrow definition. That's the Supreme Court's doctrine in recent decades. But I think under your question, there is this question of how is it possible that Clarence Thomas is ruling on the loan forgiveness case that Harlan Crow's wife has gives to an organization, the Manhattan Institute, that has an amicus brief in that case. And that, as you say, the argument seems to be personal charity for me, so my grandnephew can go to a fancy private school, but not for thee, all of you who need debt relief. So this is really like a layer cake of misconduct. And at every single layer of the cake, it is astonishing that Justice Clarence Thomas, who clearly has vested interests in every level, does not recuse.
I want to ask you one last question, not related to this court, but it's a very sensitive question about Senator Dianne Feinstein. There is very little discussion right now in the media of her mental condition. The idea that we're talking about she has a case of shingles and people are ruthless if they're saying she should resign, of course, if she just had shingles, that would be a ridiculous demand. But this issue of her mental competence and why I'm including this in this discussion, she sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and because of her absence, Democrats have not been able to approve judges. Can you respond? Last year, there was a whole discussion, even in the media. The San Francisco Chronicle last year talked about an unnamed lawmaker, California lawmaker, who expect to have a deep policy discussion with Dianne Feinstein. Instead, the lawmaker said they had to reintroduce themselves to Feinstein multiple times during interaction that lasted several hours. Congress member said she was an intellectual and political force not that long ago, and that's why my encounter with her was so jarring, because there was no trace of that. You have Nancy Pelosi accusing Ro Khanna of being sexist for saying that she should step down. But are we looking at a level of mental deterioration that is paralyzing the Democrats in the Senate? Should she step down?
It's such an echo of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg conversation that we were having a few years ago, this question of how does somebody determine for themselves, as objectively as they can, that they should step down because they're imperiling the very institution they purport to love. I can't claim to have any insider information on Senator Feinstein's cognitive state. I read the same articles you did. Rebecca Traister had a phenomenal piece last year making some of these same claims. I think I would say what I think deeply on this issue is to cloud it up with questions of ageism or sexism or questions of, you know, attacks on the senator is to really, I think, obscure the fact that, as you said, as a result of blue slips, as a result of the filibuster, as a result of her current condition, we're not getting judges confirmed as quickly as we can. She issued a statement last week saying they're going along at a fast clip, but they're really, in some ways, we're not getting judges confirmed at rates that we need to see. And it seems to me that that's a moment for soul searching above and beyond competency to say, how am I hampering this institution from doing the essential work of government?
Dahlia Lithwick, I want to thank you for being with us covering the courts and the law for Slate, hosts the podcast Amicus. This is Democracy Now! We end today's show with an update on Oklahoma death row prisoner Richard Glossop, whose May 18th execution date was just stayed by the Supreme Court Friday, pending the outcome of two cases he has pending at the high court. Justice Neil Gorsuch recused himself, likely because he'd previously dealt with the case as a lower court judge. This comes after Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General Gettner Drummond filed a joint a motion with Glossop's defense team to halt his May 18th execution, saying he didn't receive a fair trial. Glossop's maintained his innocence for more than a quarter of a century, the ninth time he had an execution date that's been put on hold. For more, we're joined in Oklahoma City by Sister Helen Prejean, Richard Glossop's spiritual advisor, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Sister Prejean. You learned of the stay for Glossop on Friday, just after visiting him in prison. Can you tell us if you heard how he responded, and what's your response?
Well, first, my response is I have never heard of an attorney general confess to error in what the trial courts had done in Oklahoma about Richard Glossop, and 8 votes to grant a writ of certiorari and grant a stay. Richard, we had been visiting earlier, and I'd left, and he was just really worried because he was going to need to turn over to the prison officials all of his personal things, his cards, his letters, his photographs, before he was taken into that waiting cell, awaiting execution, which is a torture chamber for him. He was called to the door by the warden. He went, only to find out, Richard, you got to stay from the Supreme Court. So it was just so deliriously happy. The way this happened, what made that attorney general do this? It's the hard, good work of Don Knight, the lawyer in his case, that not only pursued justice in the courts of Oklahoma, but also began to communicate with legislators and the political side of the death penalty. And these are all, 60 of them, GOP pro-death penalty legislators that Don works with, educates, then they start doing their own investigation about Richard's case, visit him, see him, meet him personally, and become very, very committed. And then in that number become the attorney general calls them. I've been with Richard two times where he came really within minutes the last time of execution. The man has gone through torture, but it's refreshing to have, for the first time, an attorney general confess error in a case, because normally prosecution and the attorney general, everybody in the state just holds fast, refuses to acknowledge error, and lets people be executed.
So, Sister Helen Prejean, what happens next? This is a temporary stay of execution? What happens?
Yeah, well, probably it'll be a 30-day at first, but I'm really hopeful that when you have eight justices taking a writ of certiorari on a case, and you have prosecution refusing now to prosecute, then it means that I believe what will happen is they'll remand the case. They'll overturn what the Court of Appeals did in Oklahoma and remand the case to the trial court again for another trial. And they're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole because they have exposed through investigation the corruption that's been present in the prosecution of destroying evidence, of allowing lies by the chief witness, supposedly that Richard Glossop masterminded it. They allowed those lies in court, hid from the jury that Justin Snead, the one who claimed with, I mean, the videos show how the detectives just pumped that information to him that Richard Glossop was the mastermind. Justin Snead had admitted from the beginning he murdered this guy. So all that stuff would come out in a new trial. I believe Richard's going to walk out a free man.
And of course,
but you know what, Amy?
Go ahead.
Amy, just all the other guys on death row that are lined up for execution, they don't have teams like this working for them. What is going to happen to them? So my work is to go to the American public. We have to bring people close to the suffering, the needless suffering, that we can keep our society safe without killing human beings. So eight of them came in for a visit while I was visiting with Richard, and they don't have those teams helping them. So they're going to Richard saying, can you get us lawyers to help us? And I just feel for them. We got to change the whole thing in the United States to get the death penalty off the table. We can't handle it.
As of January 12, 2023, Oklahoma had 39 prisoners on death row, 11 scheduled to die this year. Sister Helen Prejean, you're having a justice rally, I think, is scheduled for May 9th. What is being called for there? We just have 20 seconds. Then we're going to do a post show to talk about your history with Richard Glossop.
Yeah. So the rally, which we encourage people to come to, is going to celebrate what happened with Richard, because it's a lot of work and courageous legislators standing up for him. But to look toward the reforms that this bipartisan committee has recommended for the legislature about the death penalty in Oklahoma. 40 reforms. They've done none of them. So we got to look toward reforming the whole system, and that's what the rally is going to focus on.
Well, Sister
as
Helen
well
Prejean,
as celebration.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll do part two. Put it at democracynow.org. Sister Helen Prejean, anti-death penalty activist, author of Dead Man Walking. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.